You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You might not know her name, but it's a pretty good bet you know her work. Valerie Graves has worked in the creative departments at the nation's leading advertising firms. She's been creative director for top Fortune 500 accounts like General Motors, Ford, Burger King, AT&T, Pepsi, and many more. She's been a top executive for Motown Records and creative consultant to President Bill Clinton. Advertising Age named her one of the 100 best and brightest. But success in this tough business didn't come easily for Valerie. She was a teen mom in an underprivileged neighborhood in Pontiac. So it is quite a story she tells in her memoir, Pressure Makes Diamonds, Becoming the Woman I Pretended to Be. Valerie Graves, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I love the word you used as you write in your book, Pressure Makes Diamonds, that about growing up in Pontiac. You said, I saw no black people like the person I am today. None of them lived in the buttermilk churn of big league advertising. We're like a pesky and resilient fly. I would survive and become part of that mix. Tell us more about what drew you to advertising, Valerie.
Well, as anyone who reads my book will learn, I had a child at a very young age. I was 16 years old when my son was born. And as you can imagine, that requires having a very strong support system, which for me consisted of family, friends. The same person who babysat me while my mother worked when I was a child also later on took care of my son for me. So I couldn't really very readily leave where I grew up. And I looked around and I thought, boy, having majored in liberal arts English, what can you do with that for a living? And what I saw as possibilities in the Detroit area were publishing and advertising. Well, because of the auto industry, there was big league advertising in Michigan. So that's where I set my sights.
And arrived. It's interesting as you describe those early days. I mean, you work like working in the Mad Men era. And for those who might not be familiar with that show, talk to us about what those experiences were like for you early in your career, that good old boys club.
Oh, man. Can I first tell you about the fact that we used to ride all the time past the headquarters of Darcy McManus and Majors when I was a child, because it was at Woodward Avenue and Long Lake Road, and I would see this beautiful, fabulous, mid-century modern building, and I had no idea what they did inside that building. It said advertising. I didn't really know what that was, but I thought, boy, that is a cool-looking building, and whatever the people in there are doing, you know, I hope I get to do that someday. And it turned out to be my first job in advertising. It was a very undiverse environment, both in terms of race and gender. I think at that agency, there was one African-American producer, which was very unusual in those days, and there was one person in data processing and little old me.
Boy.
After I had been in the business about 2 weeks, one of the creative directors who was heading up the Pontiac account thought that it might be interesting to find out what a girl might think about a car. And my partner, who is a young Japanese-American art director, and I were brought into the group. So it was she and I and 22 guys in the Pontiac group. So what it was like mostly was figuring out how to think, write, joke like, you know, a white American male, you know, speaking mostly to a white audience in those days. And that's kind of what it was like to be in advertising. There were fewer than 1% of the people in the business were people of color.
It's stunning. In your book, you talk about a client years ago who once said to you, come on now, you're not really black. You're a big-time ad executive. And sadly, that person probably felt like he was paying you a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that kind of statement is still being said today? Does this attitude still exist, do you think?
You know, I know it exists because I was mindful of the comments of our new president-elect who essentially said, you know, black people live in hell, you're not realizing that many, many, many of us don't. You know, whatever may have happened in the intervening years, when the Cosby Show came along and showed, you know, this professional couple who were raising their children and leading an upper middle class life, and it doesn't have to be upper middle class, it can just be middle class, you know, doing okay. There's a lot of that, but for that client, I think he kind of thought, you know, most black people, as he thought of us, live in hell, as many people think today. And he was sort of like, you don't live in hell. You're an executive. I know you got to be making decent money. You're a well-spoken person. And essentially, I think what he meant was, you can sit in this room with me and hold your own, so you can't possibly be a typical black person.
What does it take inside your own head to get past that? Because that gives advice to others as they're patted on the head and patronized in this way.
Well, I've thought a little bit about that recently because a student asked me a question about that, you know, about kind of being able to be yourself at work, your authentic self. And I think that for everybody, no matter what color they are, there is a little bit of that. You know, there's a little bit of your authentic self that's held in reserve when you go into work because it's work. So that was a part of my reality, you know, of dealing with clients. There's a certain imbalance that's just part of the fact that you're the agency, they're the client, it's their money, they have the power. You can't just say whatever you want to a client. And so I was fairly comfortable with that. And because of my early career of always being the only black person in every environment, I was just accustomed to dealing with that in a certain way.
I know this might be asking you to pick your favorite child, but are there projects or campaigns that are especially near and dear to your heart?
Yes, you tend to kind of love them all, especially the ones that are successful or were really fun to do. But being part of, for example, of bringing back the Buick brand, which was, you know, always a great car, but really fell out of favor, I think mostly because of styling issues. We had a campaign that was part of making people reconsider Buick, and our assignment was to, you know, help bring in the African-American consumer. We became aware that the lead interior designer of the Buick Enclave was a very attractive black man named Michael Burton, and we were able to feature him in a television commercial and in a beautiful print ad that kind of ran everywhere, and it was very successful. In research, it really shattered the records for changing the minds of African-American consumers about a product. So that one's very near and dear to my heart because it held up a beautiful role model, a shining example of what you can achieve in this country, and also was very successful in selling the product. So that was one. Another favorite was, it happened quite a long time ago, but it was really fun for Burger King. I did a commercial called Fashion Statement that celebrated the kind of have-it-your-way style of African-American consumers. We had an original soundtrack, music track by Herbie Hancock, so I got to hang out with Herbie Hancock and work on it in his garage studio. And our opening scene was a young, unknown actor named Cuba Gooding Jr., who was sitting on a bridge in MacArthur Park in Los Angeles with a big parrot on his shoulder. He wasn't really even supposed to get that part, but the guy who got the part was afraid of the bird. And Cuba was like, give it to me, I'll do it. So we were able to give him that part, that commercial. You could barely turn on your television without seeing it. So that was another favorite.
There are a lot of great war stories in your book, Valerie. When you sat down to write it, what did you most hope that your readers would take away from it?
That there are things that may happen in your life, and for me, it was the birth of my son at such an early age. I was one of those precocious little smart kids that everybody just knew was going to do big things. I mean, I was 7 years old. I was probably headed to Harvard. When my son was born, there was a certain withdrawal of expectations. Not of love or anything like that, but just people began to feel like, well, that's not going to happen for her. She's not going to make it. In writing the book, I wanted people to realize that you have to hold on to your own expectations, your own person that you're pretending to be, and that that will carry you through. Your expectation of who it is that you can become, that who you're going to become, can carry you through against tremendous odds.
Valerie Graves. Her book is Pressure Makes Diamonds, Becoming the Woman I Pretended to Be. What a wonderful memoir. Valerie, thank you for sharing your story with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much for allowing me to share it here.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.